Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. It's also available to all dogs that like to listen to live broadcasting, as you'll find out in a minute. You can contact us as well by email ogc@accessradio.biz. That's ogc@accessradio.biz. Told you there was a dog. Today's guest, who is he? Well, he's an author of several books, including one about gardening. He has also written a children's book featuring a mouse called Albert. Or is it Albert? Our guest
we'll
was...
We'll come back to that.
He will go back to that. Our guest was a Baptist minister for 35 years. He is also a speaker and contributed regularly to BBC Radio 2's Pause for Thought. Or should that be Pause, P-A-W-S, for the dog, for thought? Our guest has narrated for many audiobooks, both Christian and mainstream, including Philip Goodan's May We Borrow Your Language, How English Steals Words from All Over the World. So, how did a Baptist minister get involved with National BBC Radio? How did he become an author? How did he become an audiobook narrator? How therapeutic a journey was it, and is it, for our guest when writing about his late wife? What has he learned about himself and God when gardening? Is Albert the mouse squeaky clean or a dirty rat? What is his latest book, In Step With God, about? And why do words matter to our guest? All these questions and more to our special guest and his dog, Ginny. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Richard Litterdale. Richard, thank you so much for giving us valuable time today. It's not often I can come and do a live outside broadcast, but today's different, so thank you. For those that don't know where I am, where are we, please, Richard?
So we're in a little place called Llandilis on the North Wales coast, just outside Colwyn Bay. And right now, if we look away from the microphone, we're looking out towards the blue waters of Liverpool Bay, the Irish Sea.
The wind turbines out there as well, rather a lot.
Yeah.
Which I was very sad one day when flying over on an EasyJet flight, counting out just how many there were there.
Oh, dear.
Yes. The answer is a lot.
A lot. A lot indeed, yeah.
Well, before we carry on, and the name of the dog, by the way, in question is Ginny. Hello, Ginny.
Hello, Martin.
Five important questions, or maybe not so important questions. Let's hear get on, please. Here we go, Richard. Yuck. Fingers on the buzzers, no conferring. Question number one, if you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
Well, I'm going to cheat a little bit because it's kind of two people, but I will explain the reason for
that.
Go
for it.
So I would invite Buzz Aldrin to dinner.
Very good.
He was, of course, the second man on the moon. 19 minutes after starting our meal, I would then invite Neil Armstrong, because Buzz Aldrin had to wait 19 minutes to become the second man on the moon.
Indeed.
And I figure it'd be really nice for him to be first for once. So I'll invite him first, and then his mate Neil can turn up afterwards.
That's brilliant. That fact wasn't mentioned in that song by Paul Hardcastle. No, 19, if you remember. It gave loads of other figures about, like, the average age of a person dying in Vietnam was 19.
Mr. Trick, is it?
Mr. Trick.
19
minutes.
Should have caught up on the space race. Yeah,
he did. So, okay, Buzz comes along then. What would you want to talk to him about in those 19 minutes?
Yeah, because I'd need to get him on his own, wouldn't I, really? Yeah.
Well, you could say, look, Neil, shut up, right?
Yeah, just sit in the corner.
Yeah, just do what Buzz had to do.
Yeah, it's not your turn right now. Yeah, I mean, I find the whole thing of space travel incredibly captivating. Just this past week, we've had a full moon here. You know, I cannot look up at the full moon without thinking somebody, well, 12 people, 12 members of the human race have placed their feet on the surface of that planet.
Yeah.
And I find that a very romantic notion. I mean, it's an eye-wateringly obscene amount of money that it costs to put people there. But nonetheless, I can't get away from the courage and the audacity that it took to take people there. So with someone like Buzz, I'd want to say, well, you know, forget all the press, forget the things you've said in public. Just tell me, how did it feel? How did it feel to walk on a place that no one, apart from Neil, had ever walked? How did that feel?
Yeah, I wonder what he'd say.
I wonder. I think there was no astronaut who came home unchanged. They were all changed by experience in good and bad ways.
Yeah.
Because every experience after that was too small. Once you've been on another planet, how do you top that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at the temperature on your thermostat there. It's 19.
Oh, perfect.
Another thing Paul Hardcastle didn't talk about.
There we go.
Apparently, Buzz Aldrin became a Christian. Is that right?
I don't know. I know Neil Armstrong did, because he said it was more significant that Jesus set foot on the earth than that man set foot on the moon.
That's a good line.
Well, in fact, Buzz Aldrin was a Christian already. He was a Presbyterian because he celebrated communion on the surface of the moon.
Did he?
Yep. the elders in his church provided him with some kind of special kit to do it. I don't know quite how he managed that in his spacesuit, but he did. Yeah.
See, I never knew that. I know that one of the astronauts, Shepard.
Yeah.
I think it was Shepard.
Alan Shepard. Yeah.
Alan Shepard took up a golf ball. Yeah. And a golf club. And how played, he got that on board, yeah.
Yeah. And played golf on the surface of the moon with zero gravity.
He
must
did.
Have been fun. Yeah.
And they found the golf ball recently, didn't they?
Oh, really?
The rovers. Yeah. So he's the only person.
Yeah, the only person to have celebrated communion on the surface of another planet. See, you don't need to listen to the rest. You've had,
it all now.
All these factoids coming at you.
That's good, isn't it? Imagine, after 90 minutes, can I speak? Yeah, go on then. No, you've got nothing to say. Yeah.
Heard it all before.
Wow, thank you. There's a great film about Neil Armstrong as well.
Oh, yes.
It came out a few years ago. If anybody wants to know more about Space Race, that is well worth checking out.
Gives you the human side of it and the anxiety associated with it, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. Question two, then. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please, Richard?
Nehemiah. I love Nehemiah. And there are two reasons for that. One is that I've ended up kind of speaking about him around the world in different places, in America and Pakistan and Serbia. And, but I love him too because he's really the only autobiography in the Old Testament, you know, because we get that historical story from Nehemiah's point of view. He's writing about how it was to achieve this enormous thing of rebuilding the city and rebuilding people's morale when their city was, you know, in heaps of rubble around their ankles. And I find that a very inspiring story.
Yeah.
I also find the very last line incredibly inspiring because you have this man who galvanised a population into rebuilding a city in 52 days. And at the end of it, when he speaks to God, he doesn't say, please remember me for rebuilding the city. Please remember me for being a good guy or a fantastic leader. He just says, remember me with favour, oh my God. And I think that comes very close to the epitaph that I would like. So that's why I love him.
Wow. And what's the epitaph again?
Remember me with favour, oh my God.
Thank you. Don't think we've had Nehemiah before.
Ah.
Well, maybe once at the most. Good call.
Good. Yeah, I love him.
Well, here we go. Question three. Don't forget, this can be frivolous as well. If you were Prime Minister for the day, so you could go and see, I don't know, a Taylor Swift concert or something like that, and could change any
new
law.
Pair of glasses,
and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be?
Well, here it comes, deeply thoughtful. If I were Prime Minister for the day, I would make it a legal obligation to have sticky toffee pudding at a pub whenever you have a pub lunch, because then I wouldn't need to feel guilty about it, because it would be the law. So I would just have to order sticky toffee pudding after my roast or whatever it was I had had. Because I would have no choice. So there we are. It would make pub lunches so much less stressful, you see.
Yeah, it could be the national dish of whichever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who cares?
The UK.
Who needs an excuse? But there we are, you see.
That's very good. Trouble is, I'm getting a bit bored with sticky toffee pudding.
No.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh.
I love it.
Oh, Martin, I'm sorry for you.
Sticky toffee pudding and custard is great.
Yeah. Now cream. Anyway, yeah,
anyway,
it's a good thing.
Yeah,
sticky toffee pudding is a good thing.
It is.
We can agree on that.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
If you had to impose a non-frivolous law, what would it be?
That's a lot harder. I think it would be something to do with tolerance, but it would be to do with a tolerance to allow points of view to be expressed rather than being squashed. Because I think it's quite difficult, particularly in the educational environment, for people to say what they really believe.
Yes.
Because they're frightened of the judgment that will fall upon them for doing so. And I mean that whether they're Muslim, Christian, Hindu, Sikh, whoever they are. You know, I would like to live in a country where nobody feels that they're going to be judged for expressing their fundamental beliefs.
That's great as well. Question four. Outside of family events, Richard, what has been your most enjoyable day out to date?
Okay, well, in 2018, my middle son and I travelled to Nepal, and the main reason for doing that was to visit some projects that had been supported by money raised at my late wife's funeral. Mm-hmm. So we started off in Kathmandu, but on the day in question, we were in a place called Besi Sahar, which is in the Middle Hills area of Nepal. So it's sandwiched between the Himalayas and the jungle, basically. And on this particular morning, we went to visit one of the schools that the project had supported. We were welcomed at the gate by two lines of teachers, all in uniform. Teachers wear uniform there as well as students, who gave us a bindi on our foreheads, a silk scarf around our necks. We saw the children in their classrooms. We sat in the headmaster's office and had sweet cardamom tea. And then we walked out of the village along the edge of a ravine, crossed over the ravine on a kind of Indiana Jones style rope bridge with these blue glacial waters rushing below us. and then walk back through into the village, through the jungle. And it was an utterly unforgettable day. Wow. It was like another world, it really was.
Wow. The fact that you had the mark on your forehead.
Yeah.
I'm sure there'd be quite a few fundamentalists of years gone by saying, oh, I would have refused that.
Yeah.
What does that actually signify for a start?
Well, in that context, it was nothing more than a mark of welcome.
Really?
You know, now in Hindu cultures, it's different, but these were Christian teachers. And for them, it was a cultural sign of saying, you are an honoured guest in our school. That's all it meant.
Wow.
And it would have been utterly churlish to refuse it because they wanted to say, we are honoured to have you here.
Yeah. And, you know, by saying no, you know, you would have caused more damage.
Yeah.
Sounds like a fantastic day out.
It was. I shall never forget it.
Were you able to see a certain mountain beginning with E and ending in T in the distance?
No, not at that point, sadly. But it was out there somewhere. I'm confident nobody's moved it. So.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's grown a bit since you last saw, apparently. A few foot. Question five, then. What has been your most embarrassing moment to date, please, Richard?
Well, my children would probably say there are so many to choose from, but I have picked one of them. So as you rightly said in the intro, I used to do Pause for Thought on Radio 2. And on this particular occasion, I was called in as a kind of emergency to do the one for New Year's Day. So I was in the studio on about the 20th of December recording a script for New Year's Day. Now, this was in an independent broadcaster who was subcontracted to the BBC. And so I was in the reception area downstairs waiting to be called up to the studio and thought, I'm just going to pop into the loo before I go up there. Went into the loo, already feeling nervous, pulled the light switch and the cord came off in my hand.
Hey.
I'm standing there. I come out with this thing in my hand. I think, well, what the heck do I do now? So in the end, I'd just been called up to the studio. So I handed it to the receptionist and said, I think this belongs to you. It was quite an embarrassing moment, it would have to be said.
I've got a feeling that that's been done before. So while she felt embarrassed, she's going, no, not another one. Your third one this week.
Yeah, probably.
But she wasn't going to say that.
No, no. And I got another script out of it for next time I recorded there. So.
There you go.
I capitalised on my own embarrassment, you see. It's fine.
Listen, thank you for those answers. We've got two books at least to talk about. One in my hand already, 37 Kings and a Budgerigar. And the thing is, with a title like that, you want to buy it, let alone what it's about. So there's that we can talk about later on.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, released this week, 101 Devotional Walks Through the Bible. The book is called In Step with God. The author is Richard Littledale, who just happens to be you.
I happen to be right here.
Which is fantastic. So, as a Baptist minister then, why did you want to start writing in the first place?
Well, I always loved writing. Even as a kid at primary school, I absolutely loved writing. It was just one of my happy places, I guess. Then in 2000, after being really challenged by God about it, I took a third degree. So I took a master's degree in preaching. And when I finished that, my course tutor asked me to come back in the next year and to preach the kind of example sermon at the end of the narrative preaching course. So I did that, and he then said to me afterwards, I love that, I've got a meeting with my publisher next week, do you mind if I show it to them? So he did that. This was the publishing house of the Church of Scotland at the time, St Andrew Press. And they wrote to me and said, we love this, what do you want to write about? We'd like you to write for us.
Wow.
Which was lovely. My first book was called Stale Bread, which was about narrative preaching. I wrote two more for them. Then went on to the children's books. Maybe we can talk about those in a moment.
Yeah, yeah. Did
a number of children's books for Lion. And I'm now on my eighth book for Authentic, having written for them about various subjects over the years. So it's kind of snowballed, really. But I love it. People used to say to me, well, how do you get time to write all these books?
Yes.
To which my answer was always, I get up too early.
Yeah. That's a very good answer. Yeah. Because sometimes you think Baptist ministers, sorry, I'll rephrase that because there are other ministers.
Other ministers are available.
Yeah, something to say, oh yes, but you've got to spend all your time with, you know, all the people in your congregation, yeah, and everything else like that. Writing book is one thing. But did you ever find that a struggle whereby you were like maybe giving too much time to the books and not enough time?
It was a struggle, yeah. I'll be honest about that. It was, and it was a constant balancing act. But I think also writing for me is quite a means to process things.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can get very circumstance driven in a ministry. You know, you're very driven by what happens to be happening in the church that week. And writing was a space for me to take some of that and pull the lens back and look at it on a wider scale. So I think it was valuable to me. Yeah, totally, yeah, believe that.
Because quite often, as I've said before on these podcasts, what you've done in the previous 20 years of your life, God can then use,
oh yeah,
for the rest of your life, because that actually might take you to the gifting that God wants you to use in the first place. You might not have realized it was. And maybe this is what you are doing as well. You're now using the gift that God has given you in the way of using words.
And I think ideas percolate. You know, they take a long time to come to the surface. When I arrived in my church in Teddington, I was there for 19 years. That's a long story. Anyway, I did something my first Christmas there that I had wanted to do for such a long time. So I had a nativity play enacted entirely by adults, and it was written as an adult script. Because I always said, look, it's actually quite a terrifying story. You know, a teenage girl is suddenly told that she's to give birth to the Messiah. That's not a kiddie's story. That's quite an adult story. So I did this, and we produced it. And the local paper interviewed me, and they said, oh, how long did it take you to write it? And I said, about 20 years. Because I'd had that idea going around my head for 20 years. Oh, sure, actually writing it probably took 2 or 3 hours. But really, the idea had taken 20 years to grow.
Yes.
So there's probably things I'm writing about now that God wove into my life 20 or 30 years ago. And now they're coming to the surface.
Which we're now seeing, yeah.
Yeah.
And if you go on your website, so please plug your website later on.
Okay.
You've got a piece on there where you're talking about words, and you say that words matter.
Yeah.
Why is it on there?
Because they really do. You know, I think one of the sweetest and most precious gifts God has given to me is the ability to communicate, whether that's in a one-to-one conversation or like this, a one-to-one conversation that other people end up listening in on, or whether it's in writing. That to me is one of the marks of the divine in us, that we are capable of communicating in this way. Words are powerful things. They can start a war or stop a conflict. They can forge a partnership or break a marriage. They are very powerful things, and I count it a privilege to use them. Something I've done just recently is to try and write a description of what my ministry is now.
Yeah.
Because it's very different to what it was, because I'm no longer the pastor of a local church. But to me, it's about quality now. It's about, you know, writing beautifully and broadcasting thoughtfully and serving in an encouraging way, in all those things. And a lot of that's to do with my words and how I use them.
When did you first realise that you've got a gift for writing?
Probably primary school, actually. I mean, I can remember, this sounds so funny, but I can remember a poetry writing competition at primary school. You know, sometimes a teacher recognises a flash of something in one of their students.
Yeah.
And I think I realised that...
Sorry, no.
Was it a flash of naughtiness, was it?
Not even
that. And I think she just spotted something, you know, and felt that there was a gift there. I suppose as a little kid at primary school, you don't take much notice of that. But I think that's gone on. Been there a long time, actually.
Do you remember the poem?
It was something to do with harvest, but I can't remember the words now, and I'd probably be very embarrassed by them if I read them now.
Well, I don't know. There was a young lady from Leeds. Not that.
No. It didn't rhyme that much.
Oh, one of those thoughtful poems.
Yeah, thoughtful poems that doesn't sound like one.
I can never get my head around that. So that was the start of it really.
Yeah.
And I know we've alluded already about the books you're doing now. How difficult, though, is it? Please feel free to not talk about it if you don't want to. How therapeutic a journey was it for you to start writing words on paper about the loss of your wife, what she meant and what you're going through?
Okay, yeah, let me talk a little bit more about that. So my wife Fiona died 7 years ago. She was the age of 53. She died of cancer after 10 years of fighting with it, really. And a few months before she died, you know, we had a lot of time to talk because she couldn't do much, you know, so we spent a lot of time talking. And we were talking about my future without her. And she gestured to the situation around her, which was, you know, bed and pillows and oxygen machine. And, you know, because I had said, look, I don't know if I'll ever be able to write after this. And she gestured to all of this stuff and said, you can write about this. Now, a week after she died, I was having an early morning walk in the cemetery where she would later be buried. Mm-hmm. It was a frosty morning. The grass was crunching underfoot. And it was a familiar place, but it felt strange. And it struck me how this land of grief in which I was living was a bit like living abroad, where you don't quite get how things are done.
Mm-hmm.
It seems familiar, but it's not really familiar. And so I started to blog about that. I started to write what I call postcards from the land of grief. And a bit like a postcard, it's not a big weighty document. It's not even a letter. It's an impression of what you've seen that day and how it's affected you. So I started to write these things. I put them on my blog. People seemed to love them on the blog. They were then featured on a Radio 4 Sunday Worship, which attracted one of their biggest ever post bags. and then they turned into a book. Now, writing it was cathartic, but editing it was one of the hardest things I've ever done.
Wow.
Because when you're editing, you have got to read it again and again and again and again. When I was writing it in the first place, I couldn't write for more than 15 minutes without crying. Mm. So then when you're revisiting it again and again and again, that was a very costly process. And the only thing that got me through it was the hope that it would be useful one day to the people who read it. And what I'm finding from the comments that I get back is that it is, and I thank God for that. And I think people value it because of its honesty. It's very unfiltered. So I would just write about what I was going through on the particular day that I committed, you know, fingers to keyboard. So sometimes I would write 3 cards in a week. Sometimes I'd write 1 card in 3 weeks. But I think that then brings that rawness and honesty that people appreciate.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Postcards from the Land of Grief.
And when was that written?
That came out in 2019, I think. Yeah. So Fiona died in 2017. Yeah, I think it was 2019 by the time it came out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you were told by me that I'm going to now ask you to rewrite that book.
Yeah.
Put an addendum for each postcard onto it.
Oh, right, yeah.
Oh, you hadn't thought of this, had you?
No, I hadn't.
Oh, well, there you go then. Yeah. Because, you know, 7 years...
Just reaching for my notebook here.
It's written, yeah. You could actually show what's happened from then and now. Because I get the feeling in those 7 years, the grief has diminished somewhat, but it's still an undercurrent. So you could actually maybe start, well, I'll write it again as of today.
Yeah.
And then people can compare to see just how much of a journey you've been on.
That's really interesting, and I don't think it has diminished. I think it just assumes a different shape.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would be quite interesting, actually. And in some ways, I suppose I've been doing that exercise by leading grief retreats and grief courses for people, because what I end up doing is exactly what you're describing, but doing it live. So I'm doing it with a group of people who also are grieving, and between us, we're kind of working through what they're handling. It's been interesting. I mean, I have landed up writing that book, helping to launch 2 national campaigns for Sue Ryder Cancer Care, speaking in the Houses of Parliament, you know, all these things I would never have thought I would do, nor did I want to. But now that I have this particular opportunity, I'm grateful to God that I can make use of it. So this is not a path I would have chosen, but I'm grateful for the fact that the path is strewn with blessings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For those that are about to go through it
and
listening today or just going through it, what would you say to them?
I would say make sure you've got 1 or 2 trusted friends. Don't tell everything to everybody because you will exhaust yourself by doing so. So find yourself 1 or 2 trusted friends. Tell God whatever you like. The Psalms are full of David shaking his fist at God and saying, what the hell are you doing with my life? And I would encourage you to do that, you know, to be absolutely and painfully honest with God. And find the thing that works for you in terms of processing. You know, for me, it was walking. You know, I would push out the pain in my heart through the soles of my feet. So to get out and walk was a massive therapeutic benefit to me. And it might not be for somebody else. It might be swimming. It might be, you know, painting a picture. But find what it is. And the other thing, I can remember on the morning that Fiona died, I spoke to my colleague at work, who was also a Christian worker. And she said to me what sounded very surprising, but I've learnt to accept it now. She said, oh, you've got to learn to be selfish. Because in ministry, you learn to be as selfless as you can.
Yes.
But when you are either losing someone or have lost someone, actually you owe it to yourself to be a little bit selfish and to put the guards up when you need to.
Give me an example, please, then, Richard.
So, particularly in the immediate aftermath, you know, there were lots of people who thought, oh, he mustn't sit at home on his own, would invite me around for meals. And that same friend said, look, don't accept every invitation, but don't decline everyone either. So I think the selfishness comes in saying, look, these people are going to feed me and help me. Yes, I'll go to dinner with them. These people are not, just because of the way they are or the questions they'll ask me. And so you have to feel completely free to choose between those options. Say, I will go with the one that right now I can handle. And, you know, I'm a fairly confident person.
Mm.
But I became an emotional weakling in social settings. I found social settings quite terrifying. Because what was my exit strategy? How was I going to say, oh, it's time we went now, because there was no we? So how did I decide when it was time to wrap things up and say, well, I need to get home? Yeah, it's a tiny thing, but it actually assumes enormous dimensions in your head and your heart. And that's when you realise suddenly that you are alone and you have to navigate these little things without someone by your side. Sorry, I've given you a very long answer to a short question there. But
not at all.
You know, it is a case of finding your path, I think, and being very honest whilst you're pursuing it.
And at that time, when you knew Fiona was dying, did you go out and shake your fist at God and all the pain that Fiona was going through and what you were going to do in the coming weeks and things like that?
Yeah, it's funny you should ask that because, and I really mean this, there was never any anger. There was a lot of puzzlement.
Okay.
There was tooth-breaking sadness, like I was crunching on grit. But there really was never any anger. So a lot of the sadness I talked to God about and a lot of the bleakness about, well, how do I do this on my own?
Yeah.
That I did talk about, where there wasn't a lot of fist shaking. There was more sobbing, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about your children? What did they think?
All handled it differently. They're all very different characters, and so they all handled it in their own way. And of course, they're all away doing different things.
Fiona, what was she like in the last few weeks?
Stoic, incredibly brave. Well, no, I'm going to correct myself there because she would never accept that. She said, look, bravery is a choice and I don't have a choice. She was dying and she knew it. She said, you know, bravery is for people who can choose how they react. She said, you've got to be brave because, you know, this is going to happen to me, but you have a choice about how you handle it. You know, and if I tell you that in the end I had to remove her phone from her hand where she was texting a friend who was in need, and that was, you know, 12 hours before she died.
Wow.
That tells you what kind of person she was. That she was helping people from her bed until it was no longer possible to do so. I'm very biased, but I don't care.
No, that's not biased. That's just being truthful.
Yeah.
And just showing what can happen in situations like that and how an amazing woman she most probably was.
Yeah. And I think one of the other things, you know, forgive me for dwelling on this.
No, but please.
The actual moment she died, the actual moment when, you know, I was fortunate enough that she was in my arms when that happened, you know, and that's a great privilege. I absolutely knew that as she took her last breath there, she took her first in heaven.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that because it's the kind of thing a Baptist minister ought to say. I knew it in the same way as I know where my left foot is. It was completely instinctive. And I suppose that's the other thing, particularly for people who are anticipating a death. Store the faith moments away in the bank, because then when you need it, you can draw a check. Yeah. And that's what I did on that morning. There was rain teeming down the windows. It was like the world was crying. But actually, I'd invested in the bank and I could draw a check on it of faith when I needed it.
Wow, that's brilliant. I like that. First step in heaven.
Yeah.
Which is great. I wonder what she'd be thinking if she was able to find out. Because obviously she's having such a great time up there.
So yeah.
I wonder what she'd be thinking about what you're doing now.
I often wonder that and I just don't know the answer. I'd like to think she's glad that her experience is helping someone else. Yeah. I'll find out one day.
You will?
Yeah.
Hopefully I will too.
Yeah.
So I just want to know, because if I ever had to write a book, there's no way I could write books for adults because, well, if it's got more than four syllables, I don't understand a word. So I could write for children, maybe.
Right.
With all this going on, you then start to write children's books.
Yes, yeah.
What's that like?
I love it. I absolutely love it. But for me, I suppose a children's book, it's like writing down a story that to me is in my head rather than creating it on paper. So I'll give you an example. So the first children book of mine, The Littlest Star, which has done incredible things and it's now in four languages around the world and amazing things, that started at a kind of messy church style event.
Mm-hmm.
I decided I would write a Christmas story for use at that. I then, on Twitter, it's X now, isn't it? Anyway, I refused to call it X. On Twitter at the time, I said, look, I've written this thing. How's about we try and get it published in time for Christmas?
Yeah.
And through an incredible international collaboration, in the space of 29 days, we got that book out in time for Christmas and made £3,000 for the local children's hospice.
Wow.
4 years later, that little locally published book got discovered by a book agent and it then went out under Lion's label and it's come around the world and done these amazing things. I then carried on writing stories for use at this messy church event. And then I had a meeting with Lion. I think I took 12 stories to them and they said, oh, we like these ones. Can we go with those, please? However, there were six they went with in the end. And the first of them was called Albert and the Big Boat. So it was the story of Noah's Ark told by a mouse who'd been on the Ark.
Uh-huh.
They took it to the London Book Fair along with the other five, and all the international people said, we love this mouse story. Could you tell the other Bible stories from a mouse's point of view, please? So I had the most bizarre week where I'm sitting there with three theology degrees converting Bible stories into mouse speak because that's what they wanted. So that's how Albert the Mouse became a series rather than a single book.
Can I just say, in my primary school years, the only thing I can remember from a book front being taught in assembly or whatever was about a donkey.
Right.
Called Trotmenu.
Right.
And it's by Nancy somebody or other, I think. I can't remember her name now. It was about Trotmenu, was he, as I think he's called, or Trotmenu anyway. Let's call him Trotmenu. Trotmenu is the donkey that Jesus rides into Jerusalem.
Okay, right, yeah.
So you hear all about what was going on about this master that he called Jesus through the mouth.
From his point of view.
Of the donkey, yeah. Right. There you go. Yeah.
Good old Albert.
But you've now got Albert the Mouse.
Yeah, yeah. So there are six Bible stories told by him. And that was great fun.
Wow. Well, when are you going to do some more?
When they asked me, I think.
Oh, okay.
And then the latest children's book I did was for Authentic last year. It's called Make It Grow. It was a children's gardening book. It said, look, here's 10 little projects that you could do. Because there's a lot of climate anxiety amongst children.
Yes.
They're probably more aware than you or I are about the state of the world. And I wanted to give them things they could actually do about it. So here were 10 accessible little projects that they could do in their back garden and thereby be helping the planet.
Such as?
Saving rainwater, planting things in little cracks in the pavement, you know, planting things for the bees, all kinds of stuff. Just fun.
Saving rainwater, you would think that's such a basic thing to do in the first place.
Yeah.
And yet we don't.
We don't. And if you can make it fun for children, then they'll do it when they're adults, won't they?
They will.
So
hopefully, anyway.
Hopefully, yeah.
Hopefully.
They'll probably use my book to prop up the water butt, you know. At least it's practical.
Well, exactly. Don't knock it.
Don't knock it, quite.
You know, why spend however much the book is when they could spend £30-40 more on a bespoke thing when the book would do it well?
Absolutely, yeah. Double use.
Yeah. Then have to go and buy another book.
Yeah, see? Quite, yes.
So when you were doing your gardening and everything else like that, how in touch did that put you with God?
A lot, actually. Now, I have to tell you, hand on heart, I have detested gardening for most of my adult life. My parents are very keen gardeners and I really could not be fussed with it. My first year of bereavement, you kind of get through it in a state of numbness. The second year, in many ways, is harder because you've had all the anniversaries and you think, right, okay, this is my life now.
Yeah, yeah.
This is my life. And I went out into the back garden and it was a garden that the church had prepped for their new pastor to come 4 years before. They had working parties and all of this. And it was a mess. It was overgrown and there was a bench that someone had bought, Fiona and I, and we'd put it in this pergola so that we could sit and watch the sun go down. She was too ill even to walk to the bottom of the garden. And this overgrown bench seemed to me to be a symbol of what my life had become.
Yes.
This kind of ugly, unappealing mess. And so I spoke to somebody in the church, said, look, where do I start? And they gave me some ideas. So I literally went out one morning. I spent 2 or 3 hours. By the time I finished, my arms were bleeding with all the brambles and I had this massive pile of, you know, rubbish. And I then went out to the garden centre and I got some compost and some bark chippings and I planted some things. And I felt so good. I felt so good. And I think when you're emotionally exhausted, as I was at that point, being physically exhausted is really helpful. So I found that. I think also it's very easy to feel that grief is something that's been done to you. Whereas with gardening, you are doing something to the environment around you. You are making it different before your very eyes. And I found it so therapeutic. And particularly in the winter evenings, you could make the house cosy. In the summer evenings, when the light went on and on and on, my loneliness was absolutely acute. But I never felt lonely in the garden. If I could work out there weeding or planted things or watering things until the sun finally disappeared, I didn't feel so lonely anymore. And so that really helped me. But I then started to feel that a lot of the stuff I've been banging on about from the pulpit for years about stewardship and about, you know, working hand in hand with God and all of that, I was now feeling it in the dirt under my fingertips.
Yes.
And so in a sense, gardening was earthing, no pun intended, but it was earthing the lessons that I'd said in a very spiritual way, in a very practical way. And I loved that. And now, of course, during the lockdowns, gardening shot up. It became like the third most popular pastime for every adult in Britain or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So I then spoke to my editors at Authentic. I said, well, how about, you know, writing about this? And they said, oh, yeah, go for it. So that's how Tales from an Undergardener was born. Yeah.
Well, keep it yourself. Don't tell anybody. But during lockdown, Gardener's World, whatever it's called, on BBC Two on a Friday night with Monty Don, even I was watching that.
Steady on.
I know.
Just stop it, will you?
And
stop
I have to say, hats off to the BBC person who came up with the idea of, well, why don't we get people with their phones to send in what they're doing?
Great. Yeah.
And you saw the kids doing things. And this is like, well, this is better quality TV.
Yeah.
Than, sorry, Monty, than what you're talking about, you know. And then he brings his dogs on. And
It was
phenomenal what was happening with gardening.
My parents, my dad in particular, would have found it hilarious that I wrote a book about gardening because I was always the reluctant kid that was, you know, forced at, by getting extra pocket money to, you know, clip a few weeds down. Yeah. But there you go.
Well, you mentioned getting your hands dirty.
Yeah.
Ian Coffey, who you most probably know, he was part instrumental in doing the Dirty Hands tour in the late 1980s, which is very important to my life as well. So getting your hands dirty in the garden or whatever, what did that tell you about God, or what was God telling you about that?
I think there's some stuff about stewardship, about the fact that, you know, he makes us responsible for the world, but we do it in partnership. You know, I can plant something in the ground. I can dig the soil. I can put the right stuff in the soil. I can put the right plant in. But it's God who does the magic. You know, God turns a brown bulb into a beautiful pink tulip or whatever. So I think there was a bit of humility with that. The other thing is I'm not a patient person. I'm not very good at being patient. And you have to be as a gardener. You cannot hurry anything. So for me, part of gardening was learning to hear the tick tock of God's clock in the background, that things take his time and not mine. And that was a real lesson to me. And the other thing, I'm the kind of person who likes to make stuff happen, you know, writing books and recording podcasts, that kind of thing. You know, I like to make stuff happen. And sometimes in the garden, it goes wrong. You know, you plant something and it's supposed to thrive in that kind of spot, in that kind of soil, and it all goes to hell in a handcart.
Yeah.
And rather than getting stressed about it, I found that I would just shrug my shoulders and think, well, I won't plant that again then. And that was so good for me because, again, it was about humility, about accepting that stuff works in God's way and not my way. And I knew that, but I think in the garden I started feeling it rather than just knowing it.
And putting that in context when you were going through what you're going through with Fiona?
Yeah. Yeah, again, it was about accepting that God has a plan that's hidden from our view, but he does have one and he is therefore to be trusted. And you see that, as I say, in the garden, you see you put a thing that's no bigger than, you know, your little fingernail in the ground and it turned into a tree or whatever. You think, well, how does that work?
Yeah.
It works because God works miracles.
I've asked this to other people who've been going through it as well. And I think you've already given a little clue that, you know, there's no such thing as completely getting over the grief. It's always there. But for people that you have met and no doubt will be meeting in the future where they are grieving over their loved one, then they most probably throw the line at, well, how can you say God exists when look what's happened here?
Yeah.
What would you say to them? And what have you said to them?
I've always said, yes, I've asked that question too, because there have been moments when I have. I think I would say, the reason that we hurt so much is because we loved so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think God is seen in the love in the first place. The fact that, you know, human beings can fall in love with each other and can go through dreadful things together and both become better people by doing so, that is a gift of God. Now, the price tag of that was that it was the late Queen who said that grief is the price we pay for love.
Mm.
And that's so true. But I see God in that love in the first place, which means he's not then hidden from my view in the grief in the second place. So I would want to say to people, you know, if you're hurting so much, that was because you loved that person that much, or wasn't that a gift of God? It doesn't mean that the hurting's any less, but I think it means that you savour the reasons that made you hurt in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the reaction when you say that to them?
Usually tears. Usually a lot of nodding. And actually, if they then come back and say, well, I can't feel that right now, I would say, well, that's fine. You know, you can't feel all of it at once.
No.
There will be days when God is hidden from view. Doesn't mean he disappeared. If I drive 5 minutes down the road here, I can see the mountains. I can see the Carnedhai Mountains, occasionally Snowdonia. Quite often I drive down there and I can't see them at all because the mists come in. But they haven't moved, Martin.
Yes.
They're still there. It's just that I can't see them. You know, and I think it's very much like that when you're going through any stage of grief. There will be days when you cannot see God, but he hasn't moved. He's still there like the mountains.
Wonderful answer. Thank you. Thank you for being so honest as well.
It's the only way.
There is that, because quite often we as Christians are very good at covering things up, and it's like, why do we cover it up?
Yeah.
there must have been times when you've covered things up instead of wishing to have told the truth.
Yeah.
Why do we do it?
Why do we do it? Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, the response to the initial radio programme and the book, Postcards of Grief, the overriding impression has been people saying, oh, thank goodness somebody's being honest about it. You know, because in that book, when grief sucks, I say, it sucks. And people appreciate that.
Yeah. Let's talk on happier notes.
Yeah,
that's
indeed,
okay.
Yeah.
One of your books I like to discuss in closing, 37 Kings and a Budgerigar, Advent Reflections Inspired by Nativity Sets from Around the World. What a title.
It's great, isn't it? I never thought I'd get away with that, but they let me do it.
Yeah.
So I'm pleased about that.
Well, I'm pleased because if it had been called something else, I don't know, Advent Reflections, let's say.
Yeah.
How many people are going to say, ignore that? So without putting too much at stake here, and people say, well, I'm not going to buy the book then, why a Budgerigar?
I collect nativity sets from around the world. And in that book, I've assembled 25 of them. And if you count up all the wise men and Jesus, it comes to 37. Because not every set has the wise men. And in one of the sets, I'm looking at it now, it's a little set in a, I think they call it a cabano. It's a little hut from Peru. When you open the doors, inside is a stable scene with a cow and a donkey and Mary and Joseph and the baby and an enormous budgerigar, which I just love. I mean, this budgerigar is waist high to you and I. And so that was kind of where the title came from. And so I've picked out 25 of my sets in that book and talk about them. And there's all sorts. There are Zulu ones and there are tiny ones. There's one made from zebu horn here, which is an African cow. I've got one, it's inside a bottle. And there's actually one I've got that's inside a coffee bean. You cannot see it without a magnifying glass, but there is a nativity scene carved inside that coffee bean.
Wow.
So, yeah.
The original message in a bottle, obviously.
Thank you. Very good. Yes.
So I'll throw that in there.
Yeah.
Thank you. And of course, your new book, 101, that's not what it's called, but so that's the headline, 101 Devotional Walks Through the Bible. The book is called In Step with God.
Yeah.
I like the cover as well. Tell us more about that, why you wrote it, first of all.
Okay, I started writing that when I moved here, and obviously my life was changing pace at the time. You know, so I was coming away from being a very busy pastor in a very busy church. So I had a little bit more time to walk. So that was part of it. When I had been researching another book a few years ago called Journey, The Way of the Disciples, one of the things I came out with there was that thinking pace and walking pace are pretty much the same. And I would say the same for praying. I do my best praying when I'm walking. I talk to God as I go along. And I started to get really fascinated about the walks that happen in the Bible, whether that is Noah walking up the gangplank or Joshua walking around Jericho or Peter walking on the water. I thought, what was going through those people's minds when they were having those walks? And I think the Bible is a very complicated landscape. It's got hills and valleys and forests and, you know, little alleyways. And it's very easy to get lost in there. Or alternatively, you fly over the top of it and only see the big landmarks.
Yes.
This was an attempt to get down to ground level and walk, if you like, across the surface of the Bible in the company of 101 different people. I absolutely loved writing it. And it actually revealed a lot to me whilst I was doing so. So in those 101 walks, there's a little bit of the Bible. There's a reflection about what was there in the walk and how it interacts with our lives. And then it gives people something to take with them when they go out then and walk and pray. So it's quite unusual for an author to say this, but if anybody listening to this buys the book, will you please put it down? Will you please keep putting it down? Because that's the idea, that you read a bit, you put it down, you walk and you pray, and then you come back and you read another bit. It's intended to kind of rub out the join between religious stuff and world stuff and get people to think about the world biblically.
Yeah, yeah. And for those that are unable to walk, what could they do instead, for instance?
It might be that you set aside a time to say, okay, I've read this and I'm simply going to sit and reflect on it and think on it. It might turn into prayer, but you might start off thinking, I'm going to reflect on that walk. So what, some of the most interesting ones were the tiny ones. There's a story where Joshua is fighting a battle. And if Moses holds his stick up in the air,
yes,
as long as he's doing that, it works. As long as he puts it down, it doesn't. And there's a guy called Hur, who only appears once in the whole of Scripture. And he walks across the mountain, and along with Aaron, he holds Moses' hand in the air. And in the chapter, I talk about all the hers I've met, you know, people who've done tiny things for me when I was flagging to help me and encourage me. Now, if you can't go for a walk, you could read that and say, do you know what? I'm going to sit down with a pen and a bit of paper, and I'm going to write a list of all the hers I've met. Or if you can't do that, say, well, I'm going to make a list in my head of all the hers that I've met, because maybe I've never taken the time to say thank you for them.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Peter walking on the water. the past few podcasts, people have been talking about that as well.
Okay, yeah.
So I'll ask you then, what, first of all, did you get out of that when you first, when you first read it, but when you had to think about the book and Peter got in the water, what do you think?
Well, do you know what I really got out of it? Was that I think we've been really unfair to Peter, because we major on the fact that, you know, he panics and then he starts to drown and people, you know, Jesus has to haul him out. Listen, for the first few steps, he was the first ever human being to walk on water. Give the guy some credit.
Exactly.
You know, he actually was brave enough to step out of the boat. And yes, it went wrong. And yes, we're all taught a lesson then by him looking to Jesus, and Jesus pulls him out of the water. And, you know, there are all sorts of faith lessons in that. But I think when I was reading about it and then writing about it, I wanted to say, give some credit to somebody who was brave enough to do something that no human being had ever done before. And his only motivation for doing so, you might remember in the story, he says to Jesus, call me from the boat. You call to me, then I'll come. Jesus calls, and he comes. God bless him. What a brave man.
Thomas gets bad press,
doesn't
he?
Doesn't he just,
doubting Thomas. But I'm sure he would do what most of us would do. You know, well, let's see who you really are then. Which is perfectly natural. That boat incident, when they're all in a boat.
Yeah.
Maybe people saying that, really, to find out it was, in fact, Jesus, not just an apparition that they thought it was.
Yeah, maybe that was why.
So maybe said that. But secondly, how many were in the boat? Because if it had been me, I'd go, go on, go for it, Peter. You're going to get
wet,
mate.
Let me get your phone out. I'm going to film this.
I knew you were mad.
Yeah.
He did that.
Yeah. So, yeah, credit to Peter, I think. Yeah.
Well, the idea of going for a walk and Bible characters going through my brain, as my brain does work weirdly at times, I'm thinking more about Jonah here. Because obviously he had to walk to various places because the boat doesn't go inland.
Yeah.
But the thing I'd like to know most about Jonah, I don't know what you think, so please help me out on this, is that when he's sitting underneath that tree, really, really fed up because God didn't do what he wanted him to do.
Yeah.
That's how I feel so often, you know, it's like...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What, I mean, that walk in the book is called Jonah Walks to a Sulking Spot, you know, because he does. He walks up the hill, finds himself a good spot to sit and sulk.
Yeah.
And I think we've all been there. And of course, his issue was that God was being too generous for his liking. God was choosing to forgive these people, which Jonah really didn't want to. And there's a dark little bit in your heart and mine that has the name of Jonah on it. When we see someone getting forgiven, we think, well, I jolly well wouldn't forgive them. Because that's Jonah's issue. He doesn't like God being more generous than he is. And I'm really glad the story's there, because every time I read it, it's a mirror. And I look in there and I see myself sulking back.
Yeah.
And I think, come on, Richard, you've got to change. You've got to change, because as long as your heart is narrower than God's, there's a problem with that.
No, that's a very good point. The problem with the book of Jonah is it ends suddenly. And it's like, no, what happened next?
We don't know. Did he get God's point of view? Did he carry on sulking?
Did God say, actually, Jonah, you're right?
Yeah. I should tell you, so this is an awful plug, but I'm going to do it anyway. So next autumn, I have a book coming out called What Happened Next? And it takes 52 Bible stories and literally does that. Says, let's imagine what happened next. And Jonah is in there.
Oh,
I'm not going to give you a teaser, but Jonah is in there. Yeah.
Does God agree that Jonah was right?
My lips are sealed. I couldn't possibly comment.
What a great title.
Yeah, I had such fun writing it. I really did.
And that's going to be out next
year. Spring, September 25.
And then September 26 will be the new book, your 101 postcards, with the addendums on each one, or addenda, that you've now kindly agreed with signing the contract.
the off-grid version, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow, I see, really, really busy man. And we still haven't really talked about how you got into narrating for audiobooks.
Yes,
so
tell
us more about that, please.
So that came about. So after writing The Littlest Star, I then wrote a children's story for a charity. It was a children's cancer charity. And I wanted to write a story to help siblings deal with the death of a sibling. So a story called The Little Owl. And I was doing a small pause for thought type thing on Premier Radio and talked about it. And the producer said, I know a guy who could write some music to that for you. So that's how I got to know Elliot. So he wrote some music for it. We then recorded it as an audio book. You know, sometimes you just meet a person, there's an instant resonance, particularly a creative resonance, which we had. So then a few years after that, I wrote a story called The Note. And he then found someone who writes music for film and television who wrote an original score for it.
Who was that?
Andrew Stamp. He wrote this beautiful score for it. When it first came back from him, I was in tears. It was like my little story had become Disney, you know, this wonderful music. So we then launched that on iTunes and elsewhere around the world. So I sort of got to know Elliot that way. And then he gradually moved from singing and songwriting into audiobook production. And then I started recording audiobooks for him. And still do that quite a lot now, actually.
Yes, yeah. You do. You've got quite an impressive resume, or CV, as we say over here. When you're reading these books, obviously, there must be times I would have thought, I'd never thought of something like that.
Yes, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, really, they tend to give me the heavyweight theological ones. I think, well, it's largely for an American publisher, and they want a British voice. And they want a British voice that, what did they say? Something like warmth and authority. I've never thought I'd got any of those things, but that's what
Richard Burton style of War of the Worlds. Yeah. No one would have believed.
Absolutely. So, you know, what I do find is that some of those are really complicated. So I'll read a sentence, then realise, oh, no, it doesn't need to go that way. So do you know my greatest friend? It's in the drawer just behind you, is a dog training clicker. So when I'm recording an audiobook, I have that in one hand. And when I make a mistake, I click the clicker. So there's then a big trace on the audio for the guys editing it. And then I just go again and I read the sentence again. Because I used to clap my hands. But if I clap my hands, I have to lose my rhythm by taking my finger off the mouse.
Ah, gosh, you
got you. So, yeah, I sit in here with my dog clicker and the dog takes no notice of it. But the editor takes a lot of notice. I did one book last year and it was massive. It was 190,000 words. And a guy who was then editing it afterwards, I said to him, look, you must be so sick of the sound of my voice. And he said, well, Richard, I'm not saying that, but I can see your wave patterns in my sleep. I did feel sorry for him. I did.
Yeah, I understand that. The book that I liked, well, that's all about English and where the words come from.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That was really interesting, actually. That was lot of fun because I learned so much reading that.
Yeah, but what can you remember of that time?
Do you remember that very, very hot summer? And it was the very hottest day of that summer. So I was in an airtight booth where I wasn't allowed to have a fan on, nor was there any aircon. I think I was about half the size when I came out, when I got in the morning. But I do remember it being really, really interesting. I do also remember that having signed up to do it and signed the contract, I then discovered there were one or two rather fruity Anglo-Saxon words in it where there were chapters about them. And I thought, oh, if my congregation could hear me now. But it was too late. And in fact, their analysis of those words was fascinating.
Yes, I bet.
You know, it wasn't gratuitous at all. It was saying, why do these things shock and do they shock? And yeah, it was a really interesting read. And it's probably not a book I would have picked off the shelf.
Yeah.
But because I was asked to narrate it, I then, you know, did get into it.
Well, from a heavy theological type of book.
Yeah.
What one thing can you say maybe changed you in a way of thought or pattern or deed or whatever?
Well, from these books I've narrated? Yeah. I think actually it was a book by N.T. Wright, who's a very heavyweight theologian. So those of your listeners who know their way around the New Testament, they'll be really surprised by this because N.T. Wright said, the single most important book to get your head around Paul is Philemon. Now, Philemon is a little kind of sneeze of a book. It's like 2 pages. But because what Paul says in Philemon is, if you've taken all this teaching on board, this is how you should behave in a particular example that was to do with a runaway slave. Actually, that then becomes the key to unlock all of Paul's writings. So it's not Romans or Corinthians or those heavy books. It's this little tiny one, because what you have in that little tiny book is a piece of worked theology where Paul says, if you believe this, then you will behave in this particular way in a given situation. And that was a complete eye-opener to me. And, you know, the book is 900 pages long. I would never have picked it up and read it. But because I was sat there reading it. Also, greatest moment of my audiobook life, I spotted a mistake.
Hey.
Yes!
And what was that then?
There was a quote from Luke chapter 26, and there are not 26 chapters in Luke. In your face, N.T. Wright, I spotted that and you didn't. Anyway, not that I gloated, of course, but it was a little moment of triumph.
And
possibly.
I'll edit that bit out. Or will I?
Bet you won't.
I won't, no, I'll keep that in. Yes. Yeah, it's that little thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I went to theological college. I can tell you,
Mr.
Wright. Yeah.
Got you.
We better get to the final question, which is drum roll time. Richard Littledale, thank you so much for letting me come and be here today and listen to your wise words. It's been fantastic. Thank you so much. Who is your Christian hero, please?
Well, I'm hoping he's somebody you won't have had before.
Oh, go for it.
His name is Alfred Delp.
Yes. Only last week.
Oh, no. Oh, thunder stolen.
No, not at all.
So Alfred Delp was a contemporary of Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Oh, was he?
A young Jesuit priest who was accused of opposing the Nazi regime, who was executed in prison. Uh-huh. But there's a book by him called Advent of the Heart, which consists of a number of Advent sermons that he wrote in his tiny prison cell whilst shackled. And I read it every Christmas because there is such a depth in there and such a glorious strand of hope from the grimmest place that I find it incredibly inspiring. And so Alfred Delp would be my hero, I think.
Well, I've never heard of him before. Let's fly the flag then, please, for Alfred.
Absolutely.
Tell me more about him, where he was from and things like that.
I can't remember where he was born. A German priest. And what he did, he smuggled these sermons out in his washing. So, you know, somebody would come and take his washing from the prison and he would smuggle them out. And they're just very realistic. He's very honest about his situation. He talks about, you know, pacing, probably smaller than this office we're sitting in now, yeah. His tiny cell, pacing to and fro across it, whilst all the time talking about his glorious freedom in Christ. And it's the kind of thing I could never get tired of reading.
When was he arrested?
I would probably have been in 41 or 42, I think.
What was he arrested for?
He was deemed, I think he had probably spoken out against the treatment of the Jews. I would have to research it to be absolutely sure. But I think that probably, as opposed to Bonhoeffer, was involved in a plot to assassinate Hitler. I think with Delp, it was that he had spoken out against the Nazis' treatment of the Jews.
Was he also one of the few to say, I'm sorry, I'm not having the swastika on the same altar?
I imagine he would have been. Yeah, I imagine he would have been completely opposed to that.
Wow.
But yeah, he's a great voice of hope in darkness. He really is.
Wow. Dietrich Bonhoeffer will be in all the news in the next few weeks. A certain film has been released, and may I say, about time too. But we don't hear about Alfred Delp.
No, we don't. I kind of stumbled across him almost by accident. But he's so inspiring. So Advent of the Heart is the book you need to look for by him.
Right.
Which is his collection of Advent writings.
And one particular story that comes to mind from his Advent writings, what would that be?
It's not a story, it's a phrase. He talks about lighting candles. He says, let us light candles wherever we can. You know, to celebrate hope wherever we see it. And he didn't have a lot. You know, he's in his tiny darkened cell with his feet shackled writing this stuff.
Wow.
But he's writing to you on the outside and saying, you light a candle wherever you can. Celebrate hope wherever you see it. Blows me away. Absolutely blows me away.
Wow.
Well, next time I'm having a grump, you know, I think, come on, Richard. You don't have it so bad.
That's wonderful. Richard, thank you so much for your honesty and your humility. And can I just say, your muffins that you made for us upon arriving at your house, there's a career in there as well, awaiting you.
Muffins and theology. We do it all.
Muffins of theology.
There we are. There's a new brand for me.
It is. And the punchline underneath could be, when they're scone, they're scone.
Hey!
Thank you.
Very good.
Thanks, Richard.
Oh, what a lot of fun that was.
Next time on Off-Grid Christianity.
A few years ago now, I went to a fundraising conference that was run by Stewardship, and there were some great speakers. There was Andy Hawthorne.
Yeah, he's good.
And there was various people from other fundraising trusts. And there was, if there was a common message, it was that. They said, follow the vision. Andy said the same thing about fundraising as I did. Pray, really. Follow the vision. And everything, it's so important that that's what you keep doing, because the moment you start to dilute the vision to pursue the funds, then you end up doing something you didn't set out to do.
So please join me with special guest Nigel Adams for the next edition of Off-Grid Christianity. Until then, cheerio.